I just wanted to let you know, Nate, that given it's Friday, I wore my Orca shirt just for you.
Oh, thank you.
Which our listeners on YouTube will be able to appreciate.
I'm a big fan of the Orca shirt.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is
Model Talk.
I love that enthusiasm. We've now got just 25 days until Election Day. Nate, how are you feeling?
I don't know how to answer that question.
Are you sleeping?
Some days I sleep in, most days I can't. Most days, even if I don't have a commitment early in the morning, my brain wakes me up. There are new polls and stuff. There are new headlines, right? Today I kind of slept in a little bit.
All right, well, that's good.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, from like a forecasting standpoint, this is one of the less stressful elections, right? Either the polls are really wrong or they're not. You know what I mean? And if they're not really wrong, then Biden's probably going to win. And we can't really do anything about the polls being really wrong except quantify the chance that they'll be really wrong. Now, there are other things that like are outside the scope of our model. Like, what if there is massive attempts to throw out votes from being counted, right? We've talked about this stuff, and I think people can get a little paranoid about it. But all the things that like a regular citizen would worry about are the things that I would worry about, but they're kind of not really in the scope of our forecasts.
To start things off, I'm going to lay out where things stand according to our forecasts, and then we can dig into what's changing and why, and also answer some listener questions. We got a ton of listener questions. So our presidential forecast shows Biden with an 85% chance of winning the election, and our national polling average for the presidential race shows Biden leading by 10 points. And as of today, that's the first time our national polling average for the presidential race shows Biden leading by double digits. Our Senate forecast shows Democrats with about a 70% chance of winning that chamber, depending on which forecast model you look at. And then our newly launched House forecast shows Democrats with a 94% chance of maintaining their control of the House. So, Nate, a lot has happened recently. We had the debates. We've had Trump's COVID diagnosis and the general White House outbreak. We had Trump's announcement that he would not try to pass a stimulus package before the election. Just yesterday, the FBI foiled a far-right terrorist plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer and start a civil war. Before all that, there was the Trump tax return story and the Supreme Court vacancy. There is so much going on. Is it possible to discern what's responsible for the movement towards Biden and Democrats as of late?
Well, if all the news happens on top of one another, then it becomes hard to be super precise about what's causing it. But there's reason to think that both the first debate and Trump's COVID diagnosis were harmful to Trump. For the debate, we say that because, first of all, there were polls of debate watchers saying, what did you think? And most polls of those debate watchers found people thought Biden did better, some by substantial margins. So you might expect the winner of the debate to gain ground in head-to-head polls, to gain a point or two, typically. On top of that, you have lots of polls showing that Americans think that Trump didn't do an adequate job of taking precautions around COVID. Even after he's gotten sick, he's been pretty cavalier about some things like whipping the mask off when he returns to the White House and stuff like that. So that seems to be hurting him as well, although it's a bit less certain. But yeah, I mean, look, because the polls have been so stable, then it's very dramatic, I guess, when you go from a 7-point Biden lead to a 10-point Biden lead. But a 3-point swing is not very big. If one in every 75 Americans roughly switches from Biden to Trump, then Biden's lead grows by 3 points, right? It's also like one out of 75 people. It's pretty small. So these cataclysmic events, you know, we're like, oh my gosh, double digit number. It's not really shifted that much.
Is there any precedent for a candidate losing a 10-point lead in 3 weeks?
No, not in the presidential race, but we don't have that large a sample size. And there are other precedents that are relevant. So in 1980, polls at this point were very close in the presidential race, with Ronald Reagan only narrowly ahead, and Reagan wound up winning by 10 points. So that's a big swing that would be enough if it went in Trump's direction to maybe give him the Electoral College. In 1948, I believe the final Gallup poll had Dewey up by 5 points or so, and Truman won by 4 points. So that's a 9-point swing. So these happen. They're pretty rare, right? You don't have a case where everything lines up perfectly and a candidate blows a 10-point lead, you know. look, we don't have that large a sample size. So the model's trying to infer from a handful of data points and say, okay, we can't be that literal about saying, has Kanye blown a 10-point lead? I mean, Kanye have had a 10-point lead to blow.
You mentioned the Electoral College, which brings us to a question that we've spent a lot of time talking about over the past couple years. Biden has a 10-point lead nationally, of course. Are we seeing similar movement in state polling? What's the gap like between national polls and the likeliest tipping point state at this point?
Yeah, I'd say we have not actually seen quite the spectacular numbers in state polls for Biden that we've seen in national polls. We've seen certainly very good numbers, and there are exceptions like the Quinnipiac polls that had Biden up double digits in Florida and Pennsylvania. But there are also a lot of state poll results that look kind of like they did before, which were consistent with a 7 or 8 point lead. So our polling average of national polls has Biden up 10 nationally. Our forecast has Biden projected to win by 8, because it's not a snapshot, it's a forecast. And there are a couple of important differences. One is that it's still hedging a bit the model based on an economic and incumbency prior, which would point toward a closer race. Two is that it hedges a bit after polling shifts after debate. So it waits a little bit to see if that is sustained. We're now getting in the period where it kind of has been sustained, but that matters a little bit. And third is that it mostly is based on state polls and not national polls. So the state polls might point toward more like a 8 or 9, I would guess, point Biden lead, which we're discounting to 8 instead of a 10-point lead, which is not trivial, I guess, in the scheme of things, but also isn't that large a difference.
Yeah. To what extent does the model take into consideration that the opposite happens, that instead of reverting a bit to the mean based on some of the fundamental indicators, that the bottom falls out for Trump?
Yeah. So here's one way to look at it. Our model currently shows a 35% chance of Biden winning by double digits. So since right now he's on the cusp at 10 points in national polls, although again, we think it's probably more like 9 points based on state polls. It's kind of saying, hey, there's a 35% chance that things get even worse for Trump and a 65% chance that things tighten a bit. Or again, since that's based on state polls and not national polls, maybe let's say it's 40-60, 60-40. 40% chance that things get worse, 60% chance they get better for Trump is the model's rough interpretation of the data.
We've had a lot of listeners notice that in our projected possibilities for the election, that there's kind of a significant bump in the likelihood of Biden getting around 400 plus electors to the Electoral College. Is that kind of the threshold where Biden starts winning Georgia and Texas? And how likely do you consider that? Is that that 35% chance you were talking about?
So there's a group of states that are kind of conventionally agreed upon to be competitive states. Of those states, the ones that are probably hardest for Biden to win are Georgia, Ohio, Iowa, and Texas. If Biden were to win all of those states, then he has 413 electoral votes, along with all the states that are already kind of in the lean Biden categories. So that includes like Florida, Arizona, whatnot, right? But if Biden wins all the kind of conventionally competitive states, he gets to 413 electoral votes. If he wins all of them except Texas, he gets 375. So that's why you see kind of a cluster of outcomes, either 375 or 413 are fairly likely outcomes if Biden is having a good night nationally. Once you get past Texas, then there's kind of a big gap between the next states that Biden could win. Although to the extent you have states, they're kind of small EV states, small electoral vote states, like South Carolina is 9 electoral votes, Alaska is 3, Kansas is 6, right? So that gets to 431 if he wins all those. And after that gets even harder. But that's kind of like where he's not going to get, we don't think, 500 and something electoral votes. You kind of cap out, even with a landslide, in the low 400s, probably.
I mean, what is the likelihood of that? Is that the 35% chance that you were talking about before, or is that less likely than 35%, the 413 number?
Well, I mean, if Texas is the key here, Biden has a 30% chance, 3-0, of winning Texas. And then South Carolina, he has a 15% chance. Kansas, 8%. Alaska, 22%. You know, so maybe, I mean, if you take Texas as the marker of a true epic landslide, it's a 30% chance. If you take Georgia as the marker, then that Georgia's actually a toss-up right now in our forecast. It's 50-50.
So I've a little bit buried the lead for today's model talk, and that's perhaps because while it's new, it's not maybe worthy of the lead, but we launched our house forecast this week, and it was not all that suspenseful. you know, Democrats have, according to the model, a 94% chance of holding that chamber. But does our forecast think it's likelier that Democrats will gain seats or lose seats in the House?
So actually, our model says it should be very close to the current composition on average. So it forecasts Democrats to have 235 seats after the election. They currently have 232, although note that there are five vacancies. So basically, it would predict no change on average. One thing actually about the House is that as compared to 2018, where you had this very, very broad map with lots and lots of competitive races, it's a narrower map this year. The GOP has not made that many efforts to put seats in play, potentially. On the other hand, Democrats won a lot of the races that were close, that were plausible to win. They won those, generally speaking, in 2018. So it's not as expansive a map, at least as far as we know. You know, on the other hand, in a presidential year, you don't have as much polling of House races. So there can always be races that are competitive, but we don't realize it. I mean, the model tries to assume that it says if there's not polling in a race, it knows there's more uncertainty. So it's smart in that respect. But there could be kind of some races flying under the radar.
What's the likelihood that Democrats win a trifecta of the presidency, House, and Senate?
By the way, we're going to make some of this information publicly available. We can see the joint probabilities, but it's around 60% currently. If Democrats have a 70% chance of winning the Senate, most of that is in cases where they have won the presidency, and they are pretty big favorites to win the Senate conditional on winning the presidency. So the trifecta is like 60% chance, roughly.
All right. I want to get to some of our listener questions, because we got literally hundreds of listener questions since our last model talk. And let's begin with this, probably one of your favorite questions, Nate, but something that we've heard about a lot from listeners. So the question is, how does Biden's position right now compare with Clinton's in 2016? Because Clinton did get up to an 85% chance of winning the election in October of 2016, which is where Biden is at now. So what's the difference?
Well, there is no difference in the sense that Trump will win 15% of the time. So there isn't a difference. But there are different reasons why Clinton was at 15% versus Biden at 15%. One is that our model does actually assume that there is a bit more uncertainty this year. If you'll remember, we look at factors that include things like economic uncertainty. We look at how many major headlines there are in the New York Times, right? And because there's so much like crazy news, you know, the model still does assume that things could flip around a little bit. We don't know in which direction. Number two, the model assumes that because of mail voting, that creates a bit more unpredictability in turnout. Unpredictability in turnout also implies unpredictability in the margins. So there are reasons to think that there's a bit more error this year, potentially. At the same time, Biden's lead is much larger than Clinton's was. She led by 6 or 7 points. He leads now by 10 points. You know, the model is discounting that Biden lead, by the way, right? It's saying that, hey, we really think it's going to be an 8-point win and not a 10-point win if we kind of get another couple of weeks and Biden sustains the 10-point lead in national polls and that 10-point lead translates in a clearer way in state polls in a way that it maybe hasn't yet, then the model will get more confident, right? It might get Biden up to 95%. But yeah, it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison, I think.
Actually, I think relatedly, given what you just said, we got another question that asks, is there a minimum chance the model would give to President Trump? Like the situation which you've mentioned, or if polls keep moving towards Biden, is there a baseline probability that Trump would win beyond which the model will not go?
I mean, technically not. Like, you know, I think we give Biden a 100% chance of winning Washington, D.C., for example. So the model has what we call fat tails, which sounds like something weird.
Does it?
I don't know. It sounds like some...
I think our listeners know exactly what it sounds like.
Instead of having like a normal distribution where the tails of the bell curve get very, very thin, it uses a student's t distribution where there is some unpredictability, standard deviations away from the mean. You know, instead of having a 1 in 1,000 chance of a 4 standard deviation error, it might be 1 in 100 or something instead. This is a very technical explanation. What it basically means is like, yeah, once you get up to like 97 or 98% or something, then the model, it's pretty hard to get beyond that. I don't think we're quite yet in the fat tail part of the curve. If Biden's at 85, if he gets to 95, it's not quite that either. But look, it's a pretty conservative forecast, we think, in certain ways.
Yeah.
At least provided that the kind of assumptions of the model are satisfied, which importantly include that, hey, there's some like reasonable effort to count everyone's votes. But I don't know. We're not going out on a limb here, I don't think at all, because he's ahead by 10 points.
Our fat tails are what make us conservative.
Yeah, 10 points. We're, by the way, modeling this on elections going back to 1936. If you base it on recent elections, you'd be a bit more confident. That includes Dewey versus Truman, whatever else. But like, Biden is way, way, way ahead in the polls. Can Trump do something to make the race tighter? Actually, our model kind of assumes that the race will get a little tighter. I don't know if I personally have a feeling either way, right? I mean, I think Trump is in a little bit of a downward spiral right now, where he's saying a lot of crazy things and voters seem to have discovered that these things are crazy, but we'll see. Maybe he is very good in one of these debates, or maybe I guess there only is one debate at this point. And, you know, maybe a COVID vaccine is announced, although I don't think people would trust Trump to be the bearer of that news. I mean, I don't know. It's not easy to imagine him winning, but, you know, part of doing a model is to say, hey, you know, we're not going to try and overthink this too much. And we think, after having thought about all these things very carefully, that there is a 15% chance that he wins somehow, despite all his problems.
We got a question from Catherine, which is an oldie but goodie, and something that we should reiterate because it gets asked a lot. How does the model take into account early voting, if at all? And in the past, we've gotten this question, but we haven't seen quite as much early voting. This year, by some estimates, 60% of the vote will be cast by November 3rd. So is there any way that we're trying to take into account early voting this time around?
No. And it's a little hard to know what effect it might have on the polls, right? I mean, in theory, polls should account for early voting, but how you do that, I don't know. In a poll, for example, should you take someone who has already voted as being more certain to vote than a quote-unquote likely voter? I don't think polls do that for the most part. You could argue they could, because some people who are likely voters don't actually wind up voting. On the other hand, you can have ballot spoilage from mail votes at a higher rate than from in-person votes. Although not, you know, early in person, you don't have any ballot spoilage more than for late in person. If anything, you have more time to like correct a defect, the polling place is less crowded. But no, I mean, we basically rely on polls to account for early and mail voting. If millions of people have already voted, then in theory, a late shift is less likely. On the other hand, the people who vote early usually are pretty strong partisans. The people who are undecided tend to wait. And so therefore, you're kind of maybe locking in votes you already had. But the short answer is no, we don't do anything specific for early voting.
And perhaps a related question, Alex asks, is there an adjustment based on current vote by mail rejection rates by state or district? We've heard a lot about certain states rejecting mail-in ballots already, particularly broken down by demographics. There was a lot of attention paid to, in North Carolina, a higher rejection rate for Black voters than white voters. Does our model take into account any of that information?
Well, let me put it this way. It does in a way. We assume that because of mail voting, that there is more uncertainty. But let me explain why I think it's a bad idea to assume that necessarily hurts Democrats. So generally speaking, when you talk to campaign operatives, including Republican operatives, they want people to vote by mail, or at least they don't mind it. They might probably prefer voting early in person, but generally they want to encourage mail voting. The reason why is that if you get your vote in by mail, it's more convenient, and there's no chance that something comes up on election day that results in you not voting, right? So you blow a tire on your car, or you get sick, especially in time of COVID, or your kid has an emergency, or you just kind of, you know, you're hungover and you forget about it, right?
On a Tuesday, because you've been drinking heavily on a Monday night.
The line is too long at the polling place. There's a problem at the polling place. They don't recognize you. You go to the wrong polling place, right? So generally speaking, even though there is a higher rate of ballot spoilage by mail, guaranteeing that you vote is a good trade-off, right? So maybe 2% of ballots get spoiled by the mail. By the way, 0.5% or something gets spoiled in person anyway. But if you're 5% more likely to vote or something, then it's a positive trade-off on balance. And in states that switch to mail voting, generally speaking, turnout increases. So there's a chance of an error in either direction, right? You're going to have some states probably where there is a lot of ballot spoilage. You have a lot of people voting for the first time, right? And that could cause Republicans to beat their polls. Could also be true, though, that like you already have these locked in Democratic votes. And among likely voters who are mostly voting in person, 5% of them don't show up. And so therefore, Democrats overperform their polls. So it's a source of uncertainty, and the model does account for that. But it isn't necessarily like, oh, you have to add a point to the GOP in every state. It could be the reverse.
Yeah.
Again, you could look at different states, states that have more cumbersome rules, like Pennsylvania. Maybe if you have a naked ballot, since you have to put your ballot in a secrecy envelope and then put the secrecy envelope in the other envelope that you send back to the Board of Elections, wherever you send it in Pennsylvania, right? That could be an issue. It's something that I worry about, but like there's also downside here for Republicans and all these kind of banked Democratic votes. And if you have now a less than spectacular election day turnout, then it becomes a big problem for the GOP.
So Jay, one of our listeners, noticed that there seems to be an odd disconnect between President Trump's approval ratings and his poll numbers recently. I mean, in the past couple of days, his approval rating has started to take a downturn as well. But as Biden's lead has been growing in the national polls, Trump's approval had actually been narrowing and improving somewhat. What's up with that is essentially Jay's question.
Well, I think when you get in the heat of an election campaign, that approval and the ballot become the same thing. No one's going to say, oh, I disapprove of Trump, I'm going to vote for him anyway, or vice versa. Whereas kind of early in the election, people will say, you know what, I'm a Republican, but there's this and that I would like to see the president do better on. So there are other models that use approval rating as an input. We think that's a mistake for that reason. We think approval rating is actually like kind of more of a lagging indicator of the vote preference than the vote preference itself, obviously. And this happened in 2012 too, where Obama's approval rating flipped in the final month or two to kind of match his margin in head-to-head polls versus Romney. One other thing too, there's actually like a also a bit of a gap between Trump approval and Trump favorability, where there are a handful of voters who have a negative personal impression of Trump, even though they approve of his presidential conduct. Those voters actually seem mostly to prefer Biden. There aren't a lot of them, but there is a little bit of a gap there where Trump's favorability rating is lower than his approval rating by a point or so.
So essentially, the approval rating and the national popular vote polls are converging, essentially. So yes, his approval has been going up, but it's matching basically where the polls are. So we got a question from Joseph that keys in on a specific Senate race, and that is in North Carolina, Cunningham versus Tillis. And the question is, has that race changed at all since the sexting scandal? And of course, Cunningham, the Democratic candidate there, acknowledged that he was sexting a political strategist. He's married. You know, I think in past forecasts, we've had like a lever that we can pull when there's a scandal in a race that makes things uncertain or handicaps someone. How is our forecast and how is the polling processing that sexting scandal?
So there's no lever to pull, but we actually do have, as part of our fundamentals forecast for congressional races, a scandal variable. And if a candidate is involved in a scandal, and this clearly qualifies, then that affects the prior that we use for the race. And in this case, actually, Cunningham did fall a couple of points based on that scandal news emerging. However, in races with a lot of polling, the model mostly defaults toward polling anyway, right? And polling there has not shown a big impact. We didn't make too many changes to the midterm model or the congressional model this year, but one thing we did find is that actually the impact of scandals is less than they used to be because of higher partisanship. But in that race in particular, there have been a number of polls conducted since the sexting scandal. And I mean, they look like polls beforehand. There's kind of some polls that show a toss-up, some polls that show Cunningham ahead, but that's kind of been the story all along. It doesn't seem to have shifted things that much.
We have a more esoteric question next, which is Henry writes, I know that 538 evaluates its models by looking at many races over time and seeing if the models are well calibrated, meaning when we give a candidate a 25% chance of winning, if we look at all of our forecasts over time, does that happen 25% of the time? And we've talked about this on the podcast before. In general, that is the case. Our models are well calibrated. But Henry asked the specific question, how would you define success or failure for these 2020 models in isolation? Is there a way of doing that without just kind of adding it to our whole opus of forecasts?
Not really. I mean, for the House, for Congress, and you have races that are a little bit more independent from one another. So you can kind of see, hey, are your House probabilities well calibrated in all 435 districts? Although even there, there are correlated errors. So no, you can't. The only way you can really tell very much from one forecast is if you have an extremely confident forecast that doesn't come true. So the models that had Trump with 99% chances of losing in 2016, you can pretty categorically say, and you can, I can present a more kind of Bayesian formal description of this people want, right? But like a model that for the first time it's ever conducted says 99% and the 1% happens, then the odds are that model was wrong. But apart from that, you just can't learn very much from 1 year's worth of a forecast, which is frustrating, but it's just the truth.
Next question. Why are undecided voters assigned evenly in our forecast? So essentially, what this question gets at is we forecast the popular vote on election day in specific states, nationally as well. And in order to do that, we have to make assumptions about how undecided voters will break. And I guess this listener is asking, why does it seem as though they're assigned evenly instead of, you know, breaking in one direction or another?
Because empirically, that's what works the best.
There we go. Love a short answer. Next question. If Jamie Harrison is nearly even in polls, why does the model still have him as a big underdog? And this relates to the South Carolina Senate race, where Jamie Harrison is challenging Senator Lindsey Graham.
So it has him as a 25% chance. I wouldn't call that a big underdog. So a couple of things. There's just still the slightest, tiniest little Lindsey Graham lead in the polling average. I mean, not by much, really. Maybe a tiny lead. But there are other factors we look at. The fundamentals in a state like South Carolina, even in what may be a very Democratic year, it's still a pretty red state. And so if you're using any dose of kind of the fundamentals at all, and you can kind of see races where it seems like, you know, Democrats are coming close and then they just don't get there in these red states. There have been a lot of Senate races like that in recent years. Also, you know, we use expert forecasts in the so-called deluxe version of our model, which is a default version. Those have shifted some, I think. Some forecasters now have the race as a toss-up, but others still have it as lean Republican. So yeah, basically the model is saying, you know what, polls are very close here. Maybe the slightest Lindsey Graham edge. The fundamentals are more strongly for Lindsey Graham. So it winds up being a 3-to-1 favorite for Lindsey Graham. I will say, if we keep getting polls showing a toss-up there, then the model will weight those polls more and more, and the priors less and less. But yeah, in a red state, sometimes Democrats have trouble sealing the deal. And likewise in a blue state for Republicans, if you look back in House races. And also these states sometimes don't have terribly accurate polling as compared with swing states.
I really like this question that we got from Theo. It is, which data in your experience do political pundits most overvalue and undervalue in terms of its predictive power in forecasting the election? So if we're watching cable TV, folks are talking about different indicators, explaining why their candidate is going to win or lose, if their activists are promoting one party's candidates over another, or just general analysis in the media ecosphere. What's over and underutilized?
So let me talk about a couple of pet peeves that things start to get cited at this point in the campaign that I think are overutilized. I think people overutilize, this gets to a question from earlier, data on early voting. I think people try to parse that in ways that isn't always justified by the evidence. You know, look, Democrats have a huge lead in early voting based on states that break that numbers down by partisanship. They also have a huge lead in early voting in the polls, and so it's not telling you something that the polls don't show. Another category of things, I mean, reports of what internal polls say don't add, in my view, a lot of value. Provided you have public polling, right? If you don't know anything from the public polls, and I would give some credence to reports of internal polls, it's why we, you know, in races for the House, for example, we have to use internal polls a lot because there's not much public polling in House races. But, you know, kind of the average internal poll that is publicly released is usually biased toward the party who conducts it and is not as accurate as nonpartisan polls. You also sometimes hear reports or rumors of internal polls, and, you know, that's often just spin framed to gullible reporters or not, right?
Yeah.
But if you hear reports of internal polls, someone wants you to see that report. And you have to understand their motivation. Sometimes it's transparent, sometimes it's not. But I don't want to have to, you know, play poker when I'm looking at polls and decode somebody's motivation. I'd rather just look at nonpartisan public polls that it's more straightforward, or at the very least, actual numbers that are internal polls that are released publicly. We do use those in our model, but we know empirically roughly how much to adjust them.
Here's another good question, which is kind of fun. if we lived in a country like Australia with turnout rates of over 90%, how much less uncertainty would there be in the model?
That's an interesting question.
Because we would be relying less on pollsters' turnout models because you don't have to decide who's a likely voter. They almost all are.
Yeah, I know. So in general, the lower the turnout in an election, the harder it is to predict. Because then you're predicting, are you accurately capturing two dimensions now, right? Are you both capturing the dimension of who you vote for and you don't have any bias in your sample, and also who's going to turn out? So yeah, it would be a little bit easier. I mean, turnout is sort of high, somewhat high in American presidential elections. But yeah, it would make things, I don't know, it might reduce the uncertainty by 10% to throw a number out there. Just at random would be my intuition. Maybe some Australian readers can tell us how accurate polls are in Australia.
Yeah, we have periodically received requests that we cover an Australian election. We've meandered across the pond to UK elections. We haven't gotten to Australian elections quite yet, but maybe someday. We do have a good amount of Australian listeners. We get emails a lot from Australia. So shout out to everyone in Aussie land. We love you. Let's take some rapid fire questions before we wrap up here. First question, at this point, how much of the president's odds to win in the forecast is tied to his polling versus the amount of time until election day?
So I haven't recently run the forecast when I tell it it's election day. My guess, though, is that given Biden's current lead, that Trump would have around a 5% chance in an election held today, according to our model. So if he has a 15% chance, that means 2/3 of it is from the chance that the race will tighten versus the remaining 1/3 from there being a massive, massive polling error.
Next question. What kind of results would a 2016 style polling error produce at this point?
You would still get a pretty big Biden win. If the state polls were as wrong as they were in 2016 in exactly the same states, right? So you have a big error in Wisconsin, for example. Biden still wins with 319 electoral votes, so not even that close particularly. You know, that would be enough for Trump to claw back victory in North Carolina. He'd win Ohio. He'd win Georgia. He'd win Iowa. He's ahead in Texas anyway, so he'd win Texas. But Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin would hold for Biden, even with a 2016-style polling error.
Which states are being underpolled?
Actually, one great thing about this election is there's been a lot of good, high-quality polling. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing another poll of Wisconsin. It's actually kind of emerged as a tipping point state. I mean, it kind of was thought to be one for a period of time. Biden's polling was worse in Pennsylvania than Wisconsin. That's now kind of reversed itself. Certainly Nevada is never all that robustly polled. You know, but there are also some of these more exotic states, right? I would like to see a high quality poll of
Alaska. Everyone always wants to see an Alaska poll.
We love an Alaska poll. New Hampshire, I was going to say, but New Hampshire, we actually have had several polls recently. I'm a little bit curious about Texas, where there's a lot of polls of Texas. It's not always like the highest quality pollster. It's a lot of like partisan polls, I mean by that, right? So I wouldn't mind like seeing what would happen if like the upshot CNN went back into Texas, or if ABC News, Washington Post went into Texas.
I think you probably have some people you might be able to call if you want to see an ABC News Texas poll.
They've already decided which states are going into. I don't remember which is which. You know, I mean, Iowa doesn't get a ton of polling, although it gets some, and it's not that important in the tipping point calculations. So I don't know. I feel pretty good about the amount of polling. I mean, it's just kind of like we are a little overweighted in general toward national polls as opposed to state polls, right? The state polls do not convincingly seem to show a 10-point Biden lead. So just like a random assortment of state polls would be interesting.
All right. Final question here is simply, what is up with Rasmussen? That's the extent of the question. But I assume that what they mean is historically, Rasmussen has put out really good polls, or relatively to the rest of the polling, really good polls for President Trump, oftentimes showing him tied nationally. They put out a poll this week showing President Trump down by double digits. I think it was 11 points. Is that correct, Nate?
Yeah, 11 or 12 or something.
So I guess the question is, what's up with Rasmussen? Why did they put out that poll? Are they just trying to cover their ass in case there is a blowout? They can point to at least one poll before Election Day.
I don't want to diagnose it too much. I mean, the mere fact that like we're trying to psychologize, by the way, it's not Scott Rasmussen anymore.
Right.
He's a decent pollster and a decent guy. I don't want to try to psychologize it too much. You know, maybe they're trying to cover their asses. Maybe they're trying to prime people for big Trump comeback. It's a weird polling firm. Obviously, their polls in general have a strong GOP/Trump leaning bias. Now and then they'll put out a poll that's like kind of way in the other direction. I don't want to diagnose why that is, right? They're a little different than like Trafalgar Group also tends to have very GOP leaning polls, but it's in a very predictable way. It's like take the 538 polling average and add 6 points for Trump. And that's the Trafalgar poll, like always. With Rasmussen, it bounces around more. And I try not to outthink this stuff too much.
All right. Well, we'll leave things there. Do you have any final thoughts? What's weighing on your mind as we approach the 3 week until election day, Mark?
I don't know, Galen. I don't know. And we kind of have this election anxiety on top of anxiety still about the pandemic and what winter is going to look like in the Northeast where it's cold. Usually I would be looking forward to some type of vacation. I don't know if there's going to be a safe place to go on vacation this year.
I'm started thinking about that, especially now that we don't have to go into the office after Election Day, we can abscond to Mexico. Mexico will let us in, right?
I think they're one of the only countries that will let us in. Yeah.
Thank you, Mexico. Shout out to Mexico. Friends of the pod, Mexico.
Mexico. Yeah, Galen, I don't know, man. It's uncertainty multiplied by anxiety wrapped up in an enigma of stress or whatever. But, you know, it is true that, like, there's not a lot of ambiguity in the polls about who's winning right now.
Yeah. And I will say that as pertains to election administration and essentially the different policies that are being litigated on the state level over how people can vote and what kinds of ballots will be considered and for how long after Election Day, coming through the mail, things like that, 538 is going to be starting next week, essentially a live log that's going to be rolling through Election Day, looking at some of these cases and the intricacies of how people can vote in different states around the country. So I would be on the lookout for that. I think that's going to be a really interesting project to spend time on and to observe over the coming weeks, you know, especially if this polling doesn't change all that much. I think we can still expect a lot of activity on that front. And then, of course, we also have Supreme Court nomination hearings next week. So lots to cover, but we'll leave things there. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bidigary Curtis is on audio editing. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Also, go subscribe to us on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.